Today, when I picked a popular religion, I was also showing my own context. That's a phrase used quite freely in Peru to talk about the varieties of religion that are part of the culture, part of the life of the people. So my wife pointed out to me this morning that in the United States, we don't approach it from the same angle. We bring into popular religion a variety of other sociological studies that include, of course, TV evangelists and some of the ways in which negatively our Christian faith has been popularized. So they've sort of taken the punch out of it and watered down the meaning of it, and it's kind of blended into the culture, sometimes referred to as civil religion. That's not what I was going to talk about. What I wanted to do was, since we returned from Peru and were asked to do some sessions, I found myself doing some sessions that were really tiring me out. And we spent a couple days on Job, and we had all this nice seriousness. And when they gave me five sessions this week, I said, well, I'm going to stick in popular religion, because I'd like to share it, or at least even for my own sake, do some reflection on, and in this case, to share with you some things I've learned that I think have been helpful to me, that I've enjoyed learning, but I am just a student. I do not have any great background in this. We'll have a chance, in fact, I'm looking forward to any questions you might have. But first, get us into the topic here and share the little bit that I've come to know and why that was important to me. We had been in Peru about 4 days, and they felt it was real important for us to know the work that the Lutheran Church was doing up in the mountains. It's in an area near Cusco. And Cusco, as you know, was the center of the Inca Empire. It's a word that actually means something like belly button, navel. In that area, some years ago, the Lutherans had begun some agricultural work there. And so we were to go up and see their work and go out into this little town they had been working in, a small little pueblo. Hi. A town in which they had done a study first, I probably should add that, so that is a typical Lutheran manner. We weren't out to proselytize and take people away from their Catholic traditions or faith. But here was a town with a little Catholic church, no priest. And Lutherans felt free to be there and be present in an agricultural kind of helping ministry. Well, the day we got there happened to be the day they had elected a new mayor. This is, you can visualize these really steep mountains. Peru has an interesting geography because it is like the Himalayas in one sense. It just goes from the coast up, up, up. And in this case, we're about 9,000 feet. So these people on these real steep mountains are doing their agriculture work. And this was the day in which they had kind of gathered to celebrate their new mayor. Of course, gathering means that they're drinking. And part of drinking is the traditional drink called chicha, which is a corn alcohol. So we were welcomed, included. You have one glass. Everybody uses the same glass, so they take the jug, pour you some corn alcohol, and you get this stuff. I didn't think it was real terrific stuff, but as a guest, you know, you sort of take what you get and you try to do your best with it. The trouble was there's one glass, so everybody else is waiting around for you to get done. So you got to kind of drink this stuff. And I said to the Peruvian fellow that I was with, I said, do you like this stuff? And he said, no. He said, I prefer beer. But he said, you know, this is our cultural drink. It's been here for hundreds of years. But he said, if you don't care for it, remember Pachamama. Well, I didn't know a whole lot about Pachamama, but I asked him what that was, and he said, well, we just pour out some of that chicha to Mother Earth. And I thought, oh, okay, now all of a sudden not only am I in this little town, but I'm in some of the belief systems, some of the practices of the people, which became more important as our time there, because that's how you really start to relate to people. You enter their culture, and then the exciting part is to begin to enter their belief system. Now, turns out, just as a sideline, I learned later, he thought it was better he should wait till later to tell me that chicha is made by taking the corn and chewing it up and spitting it into a pot. So with your enzymes in your mouth, you know, you can get it to ferment. And I was kind of glad he hadn't told me that earlier.
Anything ritually connected to that?
Well,
it inside and then spitting it out.
No, it's, I think, at least from what I asked some of those questions and what I began to understand, it wasn't so much a ritual thing that they chewed it and spit it out as it was a way to get it to begin to ferment. And they told me there was one other way that they used to ferment it, but most of the people found that's a real good way to do it. And I had one fella chase me around in the afternoon trying to get me to taste some of his, because it was fresher, he said. It was a very interesting day in the sense that I should add that two people had died that week, so all the women were down at the river washing clothes. You take all the clothes of the dead person down the river and then you wash them. So they invited my wife down, and Linda, of course, as she was down there, they invited her to drink the chicha as well. Sort of the men in one area, the women in another. And as we talked later, we both laughed because she said, she said, you know, that stuff was awful. But then I watched one of these other ladies and I said, what are you doing? And she says, well, I think it's a chalaya, some word that means is a toast to Mother Earth, Earth Mother. And she said, whoa, and I learned about that. And it's not offensive, although they didn't want you to pour out a lot of the chicha. It is not offensive. It is, in fact, how they see their relationship to the earth. And it's on that level of spirituality that this discussion hopefully will be based, or at least my words will relate to that. I have a couple things here that I thought were kind of neat happened to me this week. One was picked up this message from Chief Seattle. Some of you may have read this and maybe even long ago read it. This was the time when the President of the United States has asked for the land, Washington. And so Chief Seattle is writing a letter back to the Great White Father telling him what this country or this land means to him. And he goes on to say, how can you buy or sell the sky, the warmth of the land? The idea is strange to us. If we do not own the freshness of the air and the sparkle of the water, how can you buy them? See, in popular religion, if you think of it not in some of the ways we may use it in the United States, but if you think of it as the spirituality of the people, then you realize we have a clash of cultures, a clash of spiritualities as well. Something that does reflect on our Christian faith, and let's see if we can get around to that in a little while. Okay. This shining water that moves in the streams and rivers is not just water, but the blood of our ancestors. Interesting way of thinking. If we sell you land, you must remember that it's sacred, and you must teach your children that it is sacred, and that each ghostly reflection in the clear water of the lakes tells of events and memories in the life of my people connected to the land. The rivers are our brothers, they quench our thirst, and the rivers carry our canoes and feed our children. This thing is just full of what I found to be a reflection on creation, but more than that, a reflection on the identity of these people, these Indian people, and recognizing their clash with the European culture that was now moving to take over their land. He goes on to say this at the end. He says, we may be brothers after all. We shall see. One thing we know, which the whites may one day discover, our God is the same God. Thomas Merton, who some of you know his writings, he has made in one of his writings a statement that if the early missionaries, could have gone to places like South America and been open, as it were, to the Spirit to discover Christ already present in the people, we would have had a totally different sort of evangelization of Central and South America. But that wasn't the way it was. In a recent book written by Gustavo Gutierrez, what he's saying here is that he's asking kind of a question. Did they go to find God, who is the Dios on this page, or the gold? Well, good historians will tell you, of course they went for the gold. The God part of it, you see, is an afterthought, but it becomes part of the cultural trappings that the Spaniards brought. And so if you begin to think about how Christianity took root in Central and South America, think about it then, not in all the goodness of the hearts of people to share with their brothers and sisters in this part of the world the good news, but a way of dominating them. That's important, because some of these things are beginning to come up. I realized if I had a goal for this session today, one of those goals for us in the Lutheran Church, who are beginning to experience a variety of shall we call them immigrations to our country from Latin America, is that we would be more open, more sensitive, to listen to the people, to listen to the parts of their lives and faith, rather in that growing relationship, I should say, that we are become brothers and sisters with these people. That's why I would drink chicha when I don't really care for it. And I got more opportunities to do that as the time went on. And I knew how they made it by then. Which made it a little a challenge at first. Okay. We're also dealing with things that have to do with miraculous over against our scientific civilization. Things that are sometimes referred to as ignorant over against us cultured people. I'm using us in that sense because that is one of the differences with Latin America. Latins are quick to understand that we don't understand them. What I realized is I thought I had more understanding than I did. And by keeping my mouth shut a number of times, I didn't make a fool of myself or alienate people too often. We don't have a great... And here they're just on our own borders. Our northern border with Canada, we're much more like these people, sharing a variety of cultural heritage as they do. To the south, it's different. I would like you to imagine for a moment a hill, wherever that hill might be, with a cross on it. Now, certainly everybody has seen a hill or a mountain somewhere with a cross on it. If you imagine that and see that, begin to ask, why is that cross there? Is it just because on a hill far away stood an old rugged cross and we think, that's a good idea. Let's do that. Turns out, in Lima, I think every hill has a cross on it. So it begins to take on more meaning as we begin to understand that first, traditionally, there's something about hills, mountains, Mount Sinai, the Ten Commandments. They go off to the mountain for a time of reflection or transfiguration for Jesus, a time to be apart up the mountain. There's something about mounts historically, and that's not just in our own Judeo-Christian tradition, but you have the Greeks with Mount Olympus, and that's where the gods reside, in the mountain. Well, mountains, we discover, become part of popular religion. They begin to fit in, and I think I could be fair by saying, into the deep psyche of people, what they have feelings about mountains, why people might come to Holden Village and want to climb, to the top of some particular mountain. they've become some personal feelings about that. In a recent book published in 1988 by an anthropologist, she does some study in Peru. I was not able to buy the book, but I did have a chance to kind of skim it this year. And she talks about the mountain passes and the spirits and the spirit world for the people. And so in her studies, she was able to enter in with a family and travel with them and learn what mountains mean to them. And part of that understanding of mountains and myths about mountains is the cross. Now, the cross is put there for domination. The Spaniards now were the rulers of these people, not the great Inca. But in time, they began to discover new meanings for the cross. One of my really redeeming visual things in my mind that I think has been real important for me. On my first nights in the city of Lima, which is a city of 7 million people, one little freeway, lots of roads and lots of people crossing roads to get to their buses and stuff. But there was what's called an apagón, a power outage. And it was dark. Well, we were out about an hour from the center of town because the shanty towns grow outward. And as the power was off, it was first dark around us. But on the hill was the cross. But this was one that had was electric cross. And it just really stood out. And we're working with a group of youth in that particular location. And so we began to talk about that until finally the power that came from the other side of the hill finally went out on that cross too. But it was real important for me because I got to hear what kids said about the cross. And as I remember it, what they were teaching me was when you're going to be in one place for a while, you have the cross. And I just thought that was really interesting. It wasn't some depth theological thing. It had to do with the permanence of life. And what I learned later was they bring these symbols from the mountains where they've always got their cross. And they bring it to the city. And when they put it up in the city, it is a symbol of their permanence. We're here now to go fight for electricity and water and sewage. We're a community, if you will. Thing I forgot to underscore is how we use hills in terms of cemeteries, you know, boot hill kind of. So you do have, as shared here by Chief Seattle, a sense of the hill being a place of ancestors. What Seattle says at one point is to spit on the ground is to spit on your ancestors. In the ashes, in the dirt, are the ashes of your grandparents, your ancestors. So they're so connected with life. In that sense, you see, the hill has some, would the word be veneration for your ancestors? Okay, superstition or faith? There's lots of superstitions in popular religion. But I put it or faith because I think that's sort of the tension we have. Now, I'm speaking about Latin America. It may be we can talk about the United States, but Latin America is easier to talk about because much of the culture that was here has been destroyed. There's not too many Chief Seattles around anymore. But in a place like Peru, it's still there. And why is it still there? Well, I told you about this little town, Huasac. And Huasac, although just an hour and a half from a major city, has no priest. So that the evangelization that was done in this area to make these people Christians. They were made Christians. It was by the sword. It wasn't always a kind of evangelization that was completed. Or it had sort of a permissiveness about it because they weren't always able to have a priest there so that the people learned what they learned and then they kind of carry those traditions on and begin to incorporate their own beliefs with that. I wrote a quote on the board to help me get at that a little better. We have to allow the culture to speak its own Christianity, to embrace the Christian message through its own symbols and rituals. Now, if you took the first half of that, I don't know how you feel about that, If you just took the first half, think about the United States. How does that feel? We have to allow the culture to speak its own Christianity.
Brutal.
Yeah, we'd have wonderful kind of consumerism Christianity. Those of you who know California, where I'm from, there are some, every group that's going to be anywhere is there. And San Diego, there's one popular group that has bumper stickers which say, prosperity is your divine right. See, that's kind of the ultimate eyesore level of the consumerist type culture that we have.
Or guns, God, and guts got us where we are. That's another bumper sticker. Yeah.
So with the first half of that, I think it can be devastating. But to try to put it in the context of a previous sort of religious group there, we might call them pagans or whatever we want to call them, if you will. But then to add, to embrace the Christian message through its own symbols and rituals. What happened was, as there was a lack of priests, still 60 to 70% of all religious workers in Peru are foreign personnel, almost 500 years after it was conquered. That's kind of amazing, really. Which is a whole other reason, the different kind of conquering of South America than the kind of colonization that we had in the United States. But the people have symbols and they have rituals, and it was finding out that they're able to use them to express Christianity for themselves at a deeper level than we as an outsider can kind of walk in, open our suitcase and take out Jesus and our green hymnal and say, here's how we ought to do it. It's fascinating. It's very difficult, those two things. The missionaries who were in Wasak that I was referring to, the two fellows who were the pastors and their families have all left last year. That ministry is kind of in a holding pattern. One of them said, well, I don't think foreigners can do it. The other one said, well, I think you can if you're willing to stay 20 years. I think both of those are important statements. I share them because not only do we struggle with those issues together as a team, but to be able to say that those symbols and rituals that are part of the life of the people are really important. Now, we have to kind of sort through those, and I'm going to see if I can do some of that, because it is difficult not to be judgmental at times when things are very different. At the same time, to want to be open and not be so permissive that we begin to say, what are we teaching? Does that make sense, those two sides? Is that sort of like raising children at times too, I mean? Where do you stand on something? Where do you say, hey, it's not for me, it's for them to discover for themselves as they seek to understand God, put their faith together in their land, in their language, in their people. Okay. Every October in Lima, we have El Señor de los Milagros, which is the Lord of the Miracles. Now you read about that stuff and you kind of think, oh, that's interesting. But when you're there and you begin to see thousands and thousands of people, and as they carry this thing on their shoulder, maybe as much as 20 men, 10 on each side, and they're carrying a big platform with all this silver and this pitcher on it, and even the president of the country wants to get his shoulder under there for a little bit, you know. You say, okay, this is important. Now the president's gone down there and the archbishop and everybody's hanging around. This is important. Latin America has so many more saint days and special days than we do. Is that a problem? I've kind of wondered on that. We Lutherans aren't real big into having saint days and making special days for... Well, just to stop for a minute, how do we even respond to saints? Our new green worship book, it's not so new anymore, I guess, but still we don't always stop to think about the saint days. They're there, but we don't make much out of them. I had my sister last year was visiting, and her little boy was his birthday, June 29th. It turned out they wanted to go to Machu Picchu that day, so I said, well, let me babysit. So he and I were having a great day together, And along came a parade, you know, just for his third birthday. And June 29th is the day in which they remember St. Paul and St. Peter. And all over Peru, that's a big day. And this was up in the mountains. And down along the coast, you know, because Peter the fisherman and so forth, they had a boat parade and all this. And people, when they celebrate in this way, they drink. Part of what they say is numbing the pain, I guess, too, because these are heavy things. But also, it's used for the cold. And this area happened to be, that's winter time, by the way. St. John the Baptist Day, June 24th. Opposite, you might say, of Christmas Eve, if you can picture that. It's dark, it's cold, it's a big day in lots of South American places. And you have bonfires to celebrate life and light of the world. Kind of a reverse of some things we do. Now, I want to add that there are other saints indigenous to the country, just so I don't forget them. We have Santa Rosa de Lima, who as a young woman, and her compassion, her caring and nursing and so forth for people, has become the patron saint of Lima. And I believe she entered a convent and died young in life, you know, in her early 20s, and just is loved. A special church built to her honor. You have San Martin de Porres. They named shanty towns after him. He was the child of a white Spaniard and a black slave, and he is considered the first missionary in South America. I first saw him in the office of my bishop, who was Nelson Trout, in Southern California. Nelson is a first black bishop, I guess. His family gave him this little statue of San Martin de Porres. These people are part of the life and the culture. And if we look at them as an outsider, what do we see? We just sort of see something different. We can't feel it. We can't recognize that it might be affirming life and it might be an affirmation of the gospel. But if we enter into it, which takes patience, and takes listening, it takes not getting stuck, because I mentioned to you on purpose that, you know, they'll be drinking alcohol, because I knew for some people that would be the worst thing to do at church. You know, they're having the people come in with a cross and different things, and the pastor and different people are having a little alcohol on the way into church. Wouldn't go over real big, at least not any churches I've ever served. But I mention that because that's one of the barriers I realize from good Christian folk from the north. They see that and they just turn it off. They don't listen anymore. But we have to get past that, because again, that's one of the cultural parts that keeps us from knowing these people. We begin only seeing them as sort of the pagan. That's why I keep putting superstition and faith up there. And it is a tension, certainly. See. Such expressions pass from generation to generation in cooperation with the clergy, or in spite of them, address a culture's deepest concerns. And I put that over here. Their meaning of life, their suffering, and then their identity, their individual and their community identity. That's one definition of popular religion. It's at this level. Now, popular religion, to consider that if we're at that particular level, we're talking about a spirituality. I think maybe that's even a better word for us in the North than popular religion. So we get at the spirituality that connects people's meaning in life, their own sense of how God participates in their suffering, and their identity, individual, and their identity as a community. These are community events, by the way. They're not just individual. Last year, I happened to go to a workshop on appropriate technology in a little mountain village that we Lutherans are sort of involved in a project there. As I got to know the men, they said, "Oh, you've got to come next year," which meant the end of July of this year. "We really want you to be here for the Fiesta of Santiago. And I said, well, which Santiago is that? I don't know which Santiago, he says. I mean, Santiago, Santiago. It wasn't important which one. He finally gave me a name. I didn't recognize it at all. The point was, he was the patron saint in their village. So at that level, everyone participated, and they spent 2 weeks. He said, we quit working in our fields. We don't do hardly anything for our potatoes. We don't do any harvesting. We just celebrate for 2 weeks. And we dress up the first week in our traditional clothing of the area, and we just dance and dance and dance and dance. And because I also knew what else they did, and so I thought, how do you folks keep this up for 2 weeks? Because they don't tend to sleep. But there's something to note in that. It becomes a celebration of life, affirmation of life. They look forward to it. They were invited me as an outsider to it. It was part of their identity as a people. And so they were saying, we want you to join us. Okay. I haven't figured out always what these things mean in terms of this is popular religion, how does this fit in with their Christian faith and so forth. What I'm beginning to wonder at times, are we all able to let people do that because it seems to have so much in it with their identity, who they are, and if we preach against it, as some groups do, either they have to reject us or we divide the community, you see. That's happening now. That's why Mexico won't allow certain religious groups into Mexico now, because they have divided communities. Because they see it as evil, they preach against it, they get some followers, some don't, and it's kind of household against household. So the Catholic Church has spoken against this in the past. Sometimes during the colonial era, they especially were working against the popular religion. But starting in Medellin, when they had a big conference, that's a place in Colombia, and then also the Second Vatican Council, which was up to the early 60s in that time period, and then finally in about 79 maybe, in Puebla, Mexico, was the first time they turned around and said, no, we're not going to fight against popular religion. That in fact, within popular religion, it may be that it is a vehicle for the gospel, for a particular group of people. It makes no sense to the people outside of it, but for the people within it, it may be a vehicle for sharing the good news. And they've said they're going to do some more studies on that. And the little bit that I have done as research, I don't know much more than that. But it just perked my interest, because that wasn't the particular way I was raised. I had two pastors as a kid who were had been former missionaries, and usually you think about the heathen and how we're going to bring the good news to them, you know. And now I think we are in a different age, a different time. We're starting to be more savvy in terms of anthropology and sociology, to be better listeners, and to recognize that these people as our partners give us a terrific resource for ourselves and our Christianity. Because we have our Christianity, and it may fit all of our needs. At the same time, it may be one expression, and how much richer the mix is when we get to bring it all in together. This is from the president of the Mexican-American Cultural Center in San Antonio, Texas, and he says about popular religion that they are the common expression of the people's collective soul. They are supremely meaningful for the people who celebrate them. And he goes on to say that they're meaningless for those of us who are not in that pueblo, in that tradition. I like that part, the collective soul. I looked at the United States, a variety of traditions we all have as immigrants, and we've become sort of a people on the move. Where does your family live? Well, these people could all say this town. Or we had somebody go down to the city from here. But they had their community, their roots. Up here in Holden, people sometimes talk about their roots as the Midwest. They give a state or some other part of the country. Sometimes they talk about Europe, back to the fatherland. I think there is a quest for roots. And if we can begin to incorporate that as legitimate, our roots are important. Okay. Mexico, as you know, has a virgin, or maybe you're not aware of that, the Virgin of Guadalupe, Our Lady of Guadalupe, is a celebration that is very, very significant, probably more than all of the others that I ran across in South America. Sometimes we joke that every town has its Virgin, meaning that there is some appearance of the Virgin there, and they remember that and incorporate it into the community. But Mexico, anybody familiar with that in terms of just the story? I realize if some of you who travel, because Jim and Gladys Peterson are the ELCA missionaries in Mexico, and they do a lot of interpretation, I mean, that's part of their ministry. It's been a great opportunity for people to go, particularly from Minnesota, but other places, because it's close, and you do enter another world. And the particular case there, you have a Spanish army taking over a country in 1521 and destroying the whole Aztec religion, because that's how we understood paganism. I mean, they destroyed all the artwork, just everything about it that just makes the anthropologists and the archaeologists today just grieve. But it was wrong, and on top of their special holy places then would be built the cathedrals and the Catholic churches and so forth. That was our way of dominating, if I might say our. On December 12th, the Mexican people celebrate for them their identity. Because just 10 years after that conquering, 1531, a peasant, Juan Diego, has this experience. And I can't quite remember how it goes, but he is walking up this hill, which was the hill where the Aztec goddess was used to have her shrine. And I think she was the mother of all humanity. And he has this encounter with what is a mixture of this goddess of humanity and the Virgin Mary, the two things together. And so around, sun and moon are gods, and so around her is this brightness, and there's this thing on her head, but then she's also wearing the clothes of a peasant woman, and she has a belt around her that indicates she is pregnant. And that's the beginning of the story. Then she tells him that she wants a church on that spot. He goes, well, great, I'm just a peasant. Nobody's going to believe me. How am I supposed to get a church on this spot? So she tells him what to do, and he goes down and talks to the bishop, and the bishop, of course, wants proof. So finally the proof has something to do with he carries down something and it becomes a lot of roses. The bishop believes him. So they build a cathedral there. A large church. And if you were to go there on December 12th, you can't even get within blocks of this place. There's 14 million people in Mexico City, and tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people go there. Because what that manifestation of the Virgin did was to identify with the Indian, with the poor. At that point, you have them being dominated by the Spanish class. And it's a brutal experience of destroying their culture and their religion. And now through that experience, they're able to affirm part of their identity and to work, if you will, back in some of their popular religion back into the Christian faith. And it is that way today. Now, someone has gone on to say that if Mexico did not have that manifestation of the Virgin, there would be no Mexicans. And I'm not sure what that means, but I think without an identity of a people, they wouldn't be the same kind of people. Certainly they are. It is what they rally upon. And I can tell you there's many Lupes, naming the daughters Guadalupe in Mexico.
That's a part of their heritage. Okay. I want to take us back to, to the Lord of the Miracles. Didn't get to finish that. The Lord of the Miracles in Lima is how a popular religion or religious experience can begin and enter into the faith. As you know, with slavery, blacks were brought from Africa and to places all over the world, and Lima was no exception, or Peru, and they were to be miners. And they were brought into the upper areas where the mining was, and the blacks just died by the thousands. They couldn't adjust from the change to these high altitudes and the cold. As they were given freedom, they came back to Lima, and the black community found ways to kind of get together. Well, it turns out, over 300 years ago, a young black man painted the picture of a black Christ on a wall. And the blacks used to gather around that, and they would dance, and they would sing, they would talk about Africa. And then they began to have processions. And out of that kind of humble barrio began what was called the Lord of the Miracles. For despite the earthquakes and all the other things that happened, this picture has stayed together. And it was put in the doorway of the cathedral, and of course there are other things put around it. And now every year you get in the newspaper and where this picture is, which cathedral it is, what's the route going to be, and how they're all going to carry all these things to the next church, where it'll be till next year when that October day comes. Now, why is this important? They believe that in this picture and this experience, that is a time in which Christ, we're talking about Christ, will do miracles. And so people pray. And every year there's testimonies. Last year was someone who had been in a coma for 12 days, and his family prayed, and they prayed that he might be able to participate in the procession, and he came out of it, you know, that he was there. Part of popular religion is to believe in miracles. It's probably more true that Latins are much more apt to believe in miracles than North Americans. Sometimes you can sit in a group and somebody brings up a miracle, you find, boy, the whole conversation is just gone. People are sharing this miracle and that miracle. That's part of popular religion. That's what I put over here. Because these are the kind of the three entries into popular religion. The miracle, the fiesta, and the momento. So let's just kind of take them one at a time. Last week, Walt Wangren was here, and he talked about the Lakota Sun Dance. Some of you are here for that, right? Okay. Well, boy, what a chain turnover, huh? Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, that's a great tape in there, so you have to go hear it. Some of you from South Dakota and the Midwest know about this. And he talked about his experience at experiencing a sun dance. And he was very clear to talk about the dance at points and to say the leader of this particular experience was a Christian. Because sometimes they aren't. But he was clarifying that. And the reason I think he was doing that is to say the Lakota Sun Dance could certainly be considered popular religion, but a Christian could participate in that. And that's how I ended up understanding that. And that's as brief as you're going to get. Well, on that level of miracle, because in the Sun Dance people are making their prayers and they're doing a variety of things, we enter into popular religion. It's in this country, it's in other parts of the world. It's not necessarily part of the Lutheran Church. We don't have too many people participate. This is something that is actually, you would participate in the Santa Lucia in confidence that God is going to do a miracle for you or bless you in some way?
Not a miracle that bless you, but it's symbolic. It's a religious ceremony, really. Okay. And it's conducted in the churches, and it is, I mean, the saint.
It's a great honor to be chosen to portray that.
Yes.
Very few churches do it.
Well, some of the universities do, I know, at least the Lutheran ones. But what I would distinguish then is if it's a tradition that we enjoy doing, as all of us come with a variety of family traditions as well as cultural traditions, especially around Christmas, that time of the year, that tends to be our biggest tradition time. And something that is part of the fabric of the people and part of their identity, and in this case, believe that they will receive a blessing or a miracle from God because of it. Now, Fiesta, let's go on, Ruth.
Didn't Paul do something like that when he said, instead of denouncing their statue to the unknown God, he said, I know the name of your unknown God?
Yeah, he named it.
He didn't say that you should not worship this, but rather, I know the name of this God.
Good. Well, you'd never know we stay in the same chalet and we work together here.
Yeah, I will reveal him to you, yeah.
But I felt that that was an excellent example from Paul where he listens, first off, because that's one of the themes I have here, and that he doesn't, he says, I looked at them all. I just looked at them all. You know, I discovered you have one that's unnamed, and I'm going to tell you about, that's the one I know. And that's an affirming thing for people and their identity, and he's able, in that case, to share the good news. Part of the other theme of this, because you just can't help doing this when you're part of the church, is you have to look at it from the point of view of evangelism, because you're wanting to know, how can I be culturally sensitive, and yet what am I there to offer at the same time? Okay. The fiesta I've referred to simply a few times, and the fiesta is a community event, and it's a marvelous thing. If I got anything out of my time in Latin America, is I haven't danced enough. They are wonderful. They have a way that says we need to celebrate life, and they can be so poor and dirty, and children and everybody. People that seem to be as ancient as can be will get out there and dance. And it is really an affirmation of life. And I like it, because there is a whole participation of all the age groups. You can tell I was raised in a church that didn't permit dancing, so I had to grow up with thinking all these things about the sin of even thinking about dancing. Okay. Memento. Another cultural difference for us, and that can be the image of a patron saint, a photo of a dead relative, or an object that's come from an ancestor and been passed down. What are the saints that we've heard about? Saint Lucia or Santa Lucia. And there are saints that are honored for their lives, and we remember them in that manner, usually in the Lutheran Church. But for these people, it's an avenue to God. And it also represents a community and its history. The little shanty town in which I worked, they had their saint, and they once a year would march around, because that's part of who they are. And the Lutherans there could say, well, you know, that's the saint of our little Pueblohofen. I mean, it's just, well, of course. I mean, that's kind of like who we are. And there's no necessarily a judgment on it. They didn't participate, as others would kind of carry this thing around on their shoulders through the town. But it's to honor. Often they do that, of course, with Mary, because Mary, as the, could I say, the human face of God, the feminine face of God, there's a whole lot within the Virgin Mary that the people who are disenfranchised and marginalized find, like in Mexico, that she comes for them, that she is their advocate to the Father. And so they pray in that manner, that she will speak to her son and tell him what they're up to. After a while, you listen to that, you take your Lutheran theology, you set it aside, and you think, well, I'm glad Mary's around, because there's something that comes up
out of people that is really beautiful. Now, in the Lutheran Church, I don't think we ever did that or I ever heard that among any of the Lutherans, but I heard it in the others. And I felt that it was, of course, you're in a Catholic country, 95% Catholic.
So, is it August 14th, St. Mary's Day?
Is
that our calendar
observance?
Or is it July?
I don't know.
May.
Isn't there
May.
What do they call it?
And we have one Lutheran church that's called St. Mary's.
Really? Just one?
Yeah.
Oh, they honor the Virgin Mary on May Day in all of the Catholic schools.
Yeah, but I mean in the Lutheran, in our Lutheran calendar, we have
Well, folks, yeah. I just looked at my watch here, and I've been talking too much, so we're going to have to come to an ending somehow. Let me underscore just some things about popular religion. That it has arisen because you can't separate the culture from the preaching of the gospel. It's there. That a culture always gives the gospel its own particular tint. They don't have to, people who are Lutherans in Latin America don't have to be like us. Maybe they don't have to sing the same songs. And maybe, which we have bundles of questions that I was really interested to get to, and that is, can we learn as Lutherans from other people, particularly maybe Lutherans in Latin America, or can we learn from some parts of the Catholic Church? How do we sort that out? The Catholics have been struggling, can they learn from popular religion? We Lutherans, if we were to work in Latin America, which is considered Catholic country, can we learn from these people? Or, in terms of popular religion today, there's lots of religion. If you come home and you find out one of your children or maybe your spouse has become a Zen Buddhist, how do we react to that? Do we just kind of go to pieces? There's only one way to do it. Or are we able to enter into a dialogue, which means opening up ourselves of what we believe we're about, and allowing the other person to share with these things over here, meaning in life or suffering, because suffering is important, especially in Latin America, but then the identity would be probably much more common here. I was trying to make some avenues, some connections between ourselves here in the United States and this whole issue of popular religion. At the same time, encouraging you to learn from those around us, particularly in Latin America, how they do evangelism. And I'll leave you with just a thought. This is not true just of Latin America, but around the world. And one priest has written a book, which they don't have in the library here. It's called Evangelism Rediscovered. And he's been working in Africa and Tanzania with the Maasai people. And he's been doing the most interesting things. He's now, of course, being investigated by the Vatican for it. But he discovered by entering into popular religion, when often the healer person was a woman, in the way the whole community functioned because of their belief systems and their practices, it was more logical to have her do the sacrament of Holy Communion. So that's what has got him into trouble. But I found it just fascinating that he could be so free from his culture, his background in whatever country it was, and enter in with what you would call the gospel without cultural wrappings on it, but the pure gospel, if there is such a thing. Okay, thank you for coming.